Nam Dinh Thu, Republic of Vietnam, the fun capital of the world. Actually, it is not like that. Tonight before Easter, I'm sitting here in my hoop, genuine Vietnamese veteran speaking now, say all these words like hoot and buku and titi, all this pig Vietnamese that we use around here. But it's over here, it's 28th of March, the night before Easter, about 10 o'clock in the evening. I had about 45 minutes to an hour, but I thought I'd be able to get this tape done. But in working my tape, I didn't work it quite right, so I lost about 20 minutes. At 10:30, I go to brief. So tonight I fly brief at 10:30, launch at 11:30, and have a 2-hour patrol till 1:30. Get back in about a little after 2, and stay on scramble duty until noon tomorrow. And then at noon tomorrow, I fly the first patrol starting at 1 o'clock. So I've got a few busy hours in front of me. There's a good possibility I'll get scrambled maybe once, could be twice, depending, you know, if there's any action. So I'll log up buku hours tonight at least. We stay in the scramble duty about every 4 or 5 days, something like that. I'm doing quite fine down here. I got in country on the 7th. We got down to Ben Thuy, and I started flying within 2 days. I've been riding in a back seat most of the time. I started in the front seat yesterday. And the reason I've got to fly the afternoon launch tomorrow is that on my first front seat hops, they're all during the daytime. And we only have one daytime patrol. So even though I'm standing the scramble tonight, I've got to fly the one hop tomorrow to get qualified. And I'll be in the front seat, so I don't really care. If it's a calm evening tonight, I'll get a good night's sleep in the bunker anyway. I don't get scrambled, but if you get scrambled, yeah, sleep kind of lose out on it. This midnight patrol is kind of a bear. You brief at 10:30. So I was sitting around here and went to the movie after supper around 7 o'clock. Tried to go to sleep, but couldn't sleep, so I went to the movie. Get back here about 9:30, and then you don't have enough time to sleep, so you don't sleep. As I said, it's kind of a bear of a patrol because you usually don't get any sleep before it. Yeah. And when you get through with it, about 3 o'clock in the morning, by the time all the paperwork's done, you're pretty tired. Yeah. Then you're standing scramble. But I guess that's the way it goes. Jerry got down here. He was down here he got here the 21st, and he spent a couple days with me. I got him in the back seat on one of the planes on my patrol, and he flew back seat with us. It was really took some doing to get him in the back seat because everybody, they want to keep two pilots in there all the time, and because we lost one guy once, where the front seat got, well, they lost him, and the guy in the back had to fly it back. So it's squadron policy to always have two pilots in there. And I guess I talked my way around it to got permission to have him go on a 2-hour patrol also. But he didn't get to fly there. We were just rolling in on a target, and the guy in the front seat lost all his radios. And so Jerry brought him home with using his radios in the back seat. But the guy even lost ICS, his control box. Wire came off his control box. And so I guess Jerry was shouting back and forth to him. It's kind of interesting, at least. But he said he enjoyed it. And the guy that was flying the front seat said that he was really impressed with Jerry's knowledge and flying abilities for a helicopter pilot. I told him that, you know, Jerry was just a damn good pilot, too. Anyway, he came down here, and he left me this stereo. The one I'm sleeping on now, it's a little cassette stereo with, like, radio, FM, AM, FM radio in it. And it's the radio, and in one large speaker the same size. And for my 6x8 room, it works out just great. And I can tape letters on it. Of course, I don't get any background music in the tapes, but I figure we can forego the background music and listen to my talking for a while. He also brought down a Mica standby. He brought down a Mamiya C-Corp camera. It's a lot like his Suki Pentax. It looks like a real good camera. And he had picked it up there at a real good price at his exchange. And he bought a 200mm lens. And he was going to take it home, and I told him our exchanges are real grim. They had a lot better exchanges up there. Down here, they never have anything in. I couldn't even buy a radio when I was here, when I first got here. And I told him, I wanted to get a good camera, and he had gotten this one at a real good price, at a reduced price. And so I picked it up from him. So he brought me a stereo and camera and got me all set up. He also brought down an AK-47 that he had up there. That's the Russian submachine gun, something like the RM-16, but it works a lot faster, and it's kind of the M-16, you really got to keep it in top-notch condition to keep it shooting right. I don't know. I don't plan on using it. But if this base was ever overrun, it's AK. I don't know. I'd probably club them to death with it. I've got some shells for it that it'd work okay. Spray out a lot of bullets. I'm not looking forward to ever using it. I don't think I ever will. We're in a fairly secure position down here. Anyway, the Delta. Yeah, Charlie comes around every now and then. We don't get mortared or anything, so it's not too bad. When Jerry left here and was going to go to Japan for about 5 days, five days to a week, and then was gonna, come on home. He's got orders to go to Fort Benning, Georgia, which he was not too pleased with, to say the least. Going down in grit country, as I said, he was not too pleased. So he says he's going to get them changed and go to Europe, but I don't know. Getting orders changed. I hope he does. But from what he might get them changed. Well, maybe they send a lot of people to Europe. I hope he can get it done. If anybody can get it done, I suppose he can. But boy, he left here. It was here about 2 days. And then he left, went to Saigon. And he must have got the first, he was riding standby on flights out of Saigon to Japan. And he didn't know if he'd be able to get a ride out, but he must have got the first one because he was going to call me if he didn't get a ride. And so he didn't call, so I assume that he got a ride out to the airport, or he got a ride to Japan. I had to get up and take a look at my recording knob up there and see if this should be recording all right. He said he was pretty happy to get out of country. He logged a lot of hours. Boy, they get buku hours over there, about 140 a month. In his situation, well, I'm just damn glad that he got out when he did. The Army loses a lot of helicopters. And where I'm at, it was a pretty permissive environment. You know, they're not, Charlie doesn't like to shoot at us because we rain so much destruction down upon him because we can carry so much. And so Charlie will fight back, you know, if you really get him back into a corner. But if you can keep from it, he keeps his head down and think we'll just kind of shoot up the area a little bit and leave. Because if we know there's Charlie's down there and he exposes himself by shooting back, we're going to start dropping 5-inch rockets down upon his young tail end. But as I said, I'm in a pretty good situation down here. I'll cover more about my flying a little bit later. I left to give you a synopsis of my travels over here. I left San Diego and came up to San Francisco and spent about 4 days with Mike. And I never went skiing. I got real sick. I was sick for about 3 of the days. One day I stayed in bed all day. I didn't go out. But and Mike kept always promising to line me up. And he tried. I'll give him credit for trying. He really tried to get me a date, but it just didn't materialize until Monday night. Finally, the last night I was going to be in town, he got me a date. And it was kind of he called this girl that he knew, and her roommate answered the phone. And the girl he knew wasn't in. Just stand up. I'm going to have to leave here pretty soon. The XO is going to stop by. We're going to go over in his Jeep brief. But anyway, back to my story. The girl that he knew wasn't there, and this other girl answered the phone and says, "Well, do you want to go out?" And I found out why she, yes. Well, I went and knocked on the door. And when I first saw her, I thought, well, you know, she's just afraid that came over to help this Pan Am Stu get ready. And, you know, because she was not very choice. In fact, I had considered, you know, going to the door and walking away if she turned out bad, but then I thought, well, Pan Am Stu, just, they don't hire just any of them. Can't say that all Pan Am Stews are the choicest young ladies in the world. That we went out and had supper. It was pretty grim. Mike had Sherry for a date, so we stopped back at Sherry's place. And Sherry had this one girl that had her leg in a cast, Joyce. And so after my date, after I'd taken my date home, we were back there the next day. And Joyce looked at me and said, "And your brother likes you?" And this girl really not too choice. I should have taken Joyce even with a cast on her leg. But anyway. Of course, I don't know how good she was at dancing with a cast on her leg. Maybe when I come back, I'll take out Joyce. At least I know what she looks like. I had a pretty good game, but I kind of gave that up because I felt so bad. I was really sick there for a couple days. I flew back down to San Diego and checked in. Yeah. Well, I had to have a break in the tape there for a few hours. I had to stop and go to my briefing at 10:30. That was last night. Right now it's Sunday the 29th, Easter Sunday. And I'm back to my room at 5:45 in the afternoon. I left last night about 10:30. Skipper came in just when I was taping that other part and picked me up. We drove over about a mile over to the Lion Shack, and the four of us were briefing. Four pilots on a hop. I was flying back seat with this Lieutenant Commander Barton, one of the people that I went through training with. But the XO, I called him Skipper a minute ago, but the XO, Commander Rouse, was the lead pilot, and his other guy, Charlie Fail, he's JD, was. He's been here about 6 months. He was in Commander Rouse's backseat, and then this Lieutenant Commander Barton and I. We went out for about 2 hours looking for trouble. And that the moon came out, and we thought, well, Charlie does not strike when the moon is out. And we drill around the air, boring holes in the sky for 2 hours, and calling up everybody and their dog, saying, "Yeah, you know, is Charlie out?" And Chuck, they said, "No, Chuck, you know, Chuck doesn't hit when the moon is out." So everything's quiet, and we go cross country, and we usually travel along the canals, but everything was so quiet we could just travel anywhere in Delta last night, and so we cross country and. We're running low on fuel, we start heading home. And just about 15 minutes before we get home, we get this call, and this one big base is getting a bunch of incoming. And he says, "Dad, you know, we're getting incoming that Charlie just started an attack here. Can you guys come and help us?" And he says, "Well, no pops, we're low on fuel right now, but we've got two more planes sitting back at home. We'll land, and these other planes will be be sitting there, and we'd jump into them and be off probably as soon as we can. And so we just full bore it all the way home, and straight ends, and pull off the runway, pull in the revetments, jump out of one plane while the engines are still running. I run over and I just glance at this plane, check the pins, check the ordnance. I'm sitting back seat, jump in, and we start these other two planes up and they go bugging off. And I think we were airborne something like 14 minutes. We landed, taken off with these other planes in 14 minutes. We got a full load of ordnance and all this good stuff, full load of fuel. And we start heading to where we just get airborne. And this tram control, this first place that was under attack, that's where we thought we were going to go. But as we get airborne, one of our Navy centers that we're working for, this tram control is a Vietnamese outpost, Army Vietnamese thing that they had asked us, and we didn't have anything else to do, so we were gonna go help them. But this Navy outpost, in the meantime, two Navy outposts had gotten attacked, and we got in the air, and they said, switch over to so-and-so frequency. Switch over there, and this guy's down there. Oh, they're coming over the walls. They're bordering. God, they just blow up this building, you know. And oh, the mortars are coming in here, and he's screaming and shouting. So we're full bore. We go up there, and Chuck is out there in the open, and he's mortaring, so we start our runs on this Navy base about 50 miles away. And in the meantime, we're sitting at one base, shooting Chuck up. In the meantime, there's this base right beside him. This other guy's on the same frequency going, oh, they're coming over the walls, you know, they're running in our bunkers, they're shooting us up. And are screaming for medevac pilots, and it's all kind of fun and games. I'm going, hey, this isn't right. There's a full moon out. Charlie doesn't work on a full moon. But somebody forgot to tell Charlie that. And he didn't quite realize that he doesn't work under a full moon. And so we expend all our ordnance. We pull off target, and they're saying, oh no, we didn't, you know, Chuck is still out there, and he's really, really raising hell, and they're trying to get some other people up. And so we just full bore our planes right back to the squadron area, and you know, make straight in approaches, land, and I jump out of the plane while it's still running to go hop in another one, check out another plane, and we all jump back in another few planes that are fully armed. I think it took us up like 14 minutes again, or, you know, about 15 minutes. We were airborne and we got up there. Well, we knew where the position was and everything. We just zipped right up there and started raining little hell upon Chuck. And these people are, I'm talking over the phone, and the radio, well, I can imagine that the guy is, if Chuck is running over his fences and pointing an AK-47 at me, I suppose I'd be a little worried as I was talking into a telephone. But, you know, we kind of deciphered what they really needed, and we started blowing them up again. And we dumped another load of ordnance there and headed back for home. Well, in the meantime, the duty officer had called up, you know, the BOQ and got four more pilots. And they got another set of planes, two planes, and they took off just as we were landing, or just as we came near base, these other birds got airborne, and they went over and dropped the third strike on them. So we landed, and we were kind of running short on airplanes about that time, because we carried quite a bit of ordnance, and with only six airplanes, and one of them was broke down for good. The six airplanes at our base, it's kind of hard to keep flying airplanes without fixing them up. And they were trying to rearm them, and the EM's enlisted men were just working their butts off. Anyway, we landed and went into duty shack. We called them up, and we kind of suppressed. They got a bunch of Army helicopters up there and Cobras. And they, you know, about an hour later, they got enough of the Army woken up so they could go drop it in there. The Army Hilo got quite a ways to travel, and they are a lot slower than we are, so but as soon as they got there, they could actually work the area over better, because they could put in machine gun fire right on the people, where we were working with big rockets and stuff, and we couldn't drop it in as close as they wanted it. And so we sat around here, and so at 6 o'clock this morning, Easter Sunday, I thought that was kind of bad, but at 6 o'clock this morning, we finally decided we weren't going to scramble for the fourth time. There were three flights already scrambled. And they said, well, I'll just stand by. So I went to bed, and I got about 4 hours of sleep. And then we, 11 o'clock, at 12 o'clock, I had another brief, and then at 1 o'clock, I went out and flew a 2.5 hour patrol, and then went over the same area. And they had picked up a 50 cal site that was sitting up on top of this mountaintop, shooting down upon the people down below. And so, well, I'm sure the 50 cal site, either Chuck had left the 50 cal unattended, or he had taken it out of there, because while we were looking for the site, we were flying around this mountaintop for a good checkpoint type thing. And finally the guy said, well, I'll give you the exact coordinates or where the general direction of where this 50 cal site is. And so finally he says, well, actually, it's right there, right where you're flying. we made three passes, so I assumed if 50 cal was still there, that we wouldn't be. Maybe Chuck had not heard us, so we went in and rained some death and destruction upon him for a while. And so, since I had started this tape, I logged about 7 hours and about 7 combat strike medal points or some damn thing. A strike medal point is for every 20 points, get an air, an air medal or some damn thing. Jerry can tell you a lot more about it. They're a whole race, and it's the same system for all the things, but you get different points for different things, like if you're getting a race in the fire, people are trying to shoot you out of the sky, and you hit the fire and stuff, you get 2 points, and if you're just out flying around where they might be shooting at you, but you're not sure, you get 1 point. But if you fly around at 24,000 feet where they can't even see you, you only get four tenths of a point or something. But anyway, since I started this, I got logged about 7 hours of time and 7 points. Because every time I went out, though, Chuck, he was hot after our body. He was down there putting a little back up against us. Nothing real bad. Just Chuck is a bad shot. It's not that Chuck, Chuck might not be such a bad shot, but we travel so fast he can't see us. And we're too small, so it's no big thing. Well, I'm gonna go eat dinner. The breakfast of pears that I had this morning is slowly wearing off, so I think I'll drop this tape for a while and catch you up later. But, well, I don't know. I'm looking over the tape here. I guess it's only got a couple more minutes on my side. So I'll at least talk out the side. It'll probably just be nothing what I'm talking about. But I suppose, yeah, like last night, it was... I guess it wasn't much. As far as last night went, while we were being scrambled, I couldn't fly in front seat. So, because I'm not qualified yet. So I didn't get any time at all. But this afternoon I went in and we worked out the physical site. And as I said, I don't know if Chuck was down there. He was a damn fool for not shooting us down. Of course, he might not have got us anyway, but if he was down there and hiding, he's probably not down there anymore. But it's my second hop out of flying. I think I mentioned my first one already. I went out and helped this. I just got back from supper. I broke at the end of the other half there. Went and ate supper. Just found out I got the super good deal tonight. They had such a deal for me. Seems like Charlie likes Easter. There's celebrations and big bangs or something. And I guess last night they figured it was kind of a start, but tonight is going to be worse. So everybody's going to be flying tonight. And so I'm going to get back out again at 12:30. Not 12:30 brief, the airborne at 1:30. 2-hour patrol, and we'll keep planes in the air for 24 hours a day for the next few days. And because it takes 4 people a flight for 2 hours, let's see how many people is that a day? It'd be 12. There's 12 2-hour flights. Before, that'd be 48 people. That's with 18 pilots. That's flying 3 2-hour patrols a day. So they're gonna keep us pretty busy, I guess. The next few days here, I had to come back and get some sleep. I mean, kind of thought I was off for a while. I guess not. It's better. I get more time this way. I wish I was sitting on the front seat, though. I would like to, front seat's a lot better. Front seat, you do something. Back seat, back seat, still get enjoyment out of it. Helping the guy out up front. But, I'd rather be up front. I can't, on his night patrol, I'm not qualified for night yet, so. So I won't be able to fly in front seat, so. That's brakes. As I was saying, saying just before the tape ran out, the first time I went out over here, we went out on patrol for a couple hours. We were coming home. We looked for a target, and we found a Chinook was going in and extracting this helicopter that had got shot down. And so they says, Black Pony, if you want you to come over here. Black Pony, by the way, is in my squadron. Or the Bronco Busters, fly the Bronco. This is Black Ponies, and I would like you to come over here and support us while we do this. So I'm going in there and shooting. And the commander, this DXO, is in the other plane, and he's behind me. And I guess he looks over and he notices that he puffs the smoke right over by this helicopter that's being extracted by this Chinook. It was a Huey that was down. And he said, "Damn, Sikorsky, you're really bad. You're shooting about 300 meters off. You're about ready to down one of our helicopters." And I look over there and I see these puffs of smoke. I said, "Damn, either I'm off and I'm getting my rockets are doing a couple 360s in the air before they hit because it's taking them so long, or the commander's shooting that bad." And we finally realize that Chuck is down there. He's trying to wipe us out and wipe out the helicopter at the same time. And it just happened that we're putting our stripes is where Chuck has got a bunch of mortar sites set up. And, well, of course, Chuck doesn't like us kind of messing up his aim for his mortars. So he's trying to give us a ration of garbage. But so I'm sitting there. I think it's all fun and games, you know, just kind of a training-type mission. Pickling off this thing, and I pick out a hooch, and I said, "Well, I wonder if I can hit it." And I drill a big old 5-inch Zuni down there, and this guy on the ground, this army guy, goes, "Damn, right in the center of it. He's good shooting, Black Pony, just wiped it out." So we get off, and I don't hear anything about it until last night, and I guess it came through from a general or something in the army had heard about this. And I guess the helicopter crew that was, the Chinook crew that was pulling the other one out, said that with the kind of fire they'd been taking, that they probably would have got shot down if we wouldn't have been in there and kind of told Jeff to go home. Anyway, diverted Chuck for a while. Yeah. So a message came through that everybody on that flight should get an attaboy at least, if not some kind of a commendation. And I'm going, "Oh, damn," and I thought it was a training op. Anyway, that's... Jerry will probably hear this and go flat out of his mind. And it isn't. Everything that happens over here is what happens at the right time. And now, hell, it's probably nothing will ever come of it. probably in a good training hop. I learned something out of it, I think. And getting back to my agenda on leaving San Francisco, I had started this earlier, but I left Mike. It was been a few days with Mike, and then I took off, went back to San Diego. Got all checked out of the squadron. Spent one night in town taking taxis. Yuck, yuck. And then the next day I came back and went to Travis Air Force Base, right outside of San Francisco. Meantime, Mike was over in Sacramento, which isn't that far away, in the Air National Guard. His guard unit was flying out of Sacramento, and he came over to Travis, and he had a friend of his, Jim Brewer, from Bozeman. And I think everybody remembers Raylene Sullivan. She was in Billings when we had that lawsuit. She went out with me a couple times. Anyway, she's down at Travis, and so I had a date with her. And Mike and Sherry were there, and we all went over to Jim's place my last night in town. And I called everybody that night. Yes, Jim had all kinds of things to celebrate with. I could see no reason of not celebrating because my last. Anyway, so I think I talked to everybody to kind of get the gist of where I was. Had a great dinner, real good meal. The only trouble is these drinks that he was given were just a little too big for the kid here. He had a hard time on a flight next day. I met a couple of the people I went to Bozeman with that were in the squadron there in the Air Force, and went over, and there were, well, in that area, in the Travis area, there were 19 people that I went to college with. So I went over and saw about 10 of them or so. And then Raylene took me to the airport the next morning. And Mike came down, saw him before I left, and I took off. Left Travis, flying Capital Airways jet, 22 hours into Saigon. First went to Alaska, Anchorage. Had about an hour and a half layover. Flew to Tokyo. We had a couple hour layover, an hour and a half, I guess. And flew into Saigon. Got in Saigon. We left in the morning in Travis. Got into Saigon about midnight. Got checked into a hotel. A hotel, which didn't have any room. Got checked in there about 3 in the morning. Didn't have any place for us to stay. And we just kind of laid around there for a while. And then the next morning we got processed out of Saigon and ended up down here in Mentui. A squadron sent up some helicopters from our Seawolf detachment, or a sister detachment that works with us. They sent them down there, picked us up, brought us down to Bentui. On a flight, I met this flight. It was probably, I think there were 217 of us. 215 guys, 2 girls. And I don't know what the other one looked like, but I sat by one of them. 22 hours. She was a Peace Corps volunteer for 2 years and had worked out of Thailand. And of course she had very righteous views about all kinds of things, but she's pretty sharp. She's damn sharp, in fact. She's in Saigon. But, I don't know, maybe in 6 months I'll get up and talk to her. She's a pretty good kid. She came over here. She accepted a job over here teaching English, or being an English supervisor to Vietnamese. She knows all these Southeast Asian languages. I think she knows 7 languages or something. And she's sharp as hell. She's teaching English to them, but she knows their language too. And she supervises the people that are teaching English. And she gets something like $20,000 a year. Really good pay. And she's living in Saigon. But, not a bad kid. I guess it was good talking to her. 22 hours. Anyway, we got down here in beautiful downtown Bantui. And I got moved into a room, or I just moved into a room. One of the guys left. And he fixed up the room fairly well. We live in a BOQ that's boarded up on 3 sides and then screen on the 4th side. About halfway up, there's plywood down below. Well, this guy walled in most of it and put in an air conditioner. And so it's working out real nice. I'm sitting here in an air conditioned room. Jerry just thought it was really great. The only way to be fighting a war. So I've got pretty good comfort. It's kind of small, 6x8, but it's big enough, and you keep busy enough down here, or it doesn't matter. I live about 3 blocks from our squadron spaces where we keep our admin and stuff, and our maintenance shop. But from where we fly out of is about 2 miles away over at Air Force Bantui. And this is a Vietnamese Air Force Bantui where the Vietnamese own the tower and we're just using their spaces. And I tell you, the first few days, well, even now, when a guy gives me clearance to take off, you know, or even Rogers you back on what you ask, you're not sure if he's really said Roger or what he said, because it's kind of hard to keep up with that. Their talk. The weirdest thing is when you get out on the runway, you're holding, or not holding short, you're in position and hold for takeoff. Yeah. These A-37s come around, and you realize the A-37s are, at this base, are owned by the Vietnamese, and they're flown by Vietnamese. And so you have a Vietnamese pilot, and you've got a Vietnamese ground controller. Well, they use Vietnamese for, you know, telling him what to do. And you're sitting there saying, well, of course, you know, he's going to tell a guy to wave off. He isn't going to have this guy land because I'm sitting down here on the runway. And you hear this chatter over the radio, you know, the pilot in the A-37 going, and then my tower operator, which when you hear the effect of the mic, you just feel, well, he's going to say, You're going to have to take it off because we have some black ponies going to be taking off here. You know, you're going to have to take it around. But then you hear the tower operator say, and you don't know if he has cleared the A-37 to land on top of you or to shoot you down or what he's going to do. And you say, hey, would you tell me what you're telling him? That's all fun and games. It's really great because they're reworking the runway. And it used to be the first 1,200 feet are closed. And so every time you take the runway or every time you clear the land, it'd be the normal guy would say, Roger, Black Pony 13, you are cleared to land. The first 1,200 feet of runway 06 are closed for construction or something. But no, over here it's Roger, Black Pony, cleared to land. The 600 feet closed. You know, and you don't know. You know, say again. And they don't. They only use one-syllable words, and so they don't really understand what two-syllable words are. So it's fun and games. Very interesting. Anyway, after I got here, I started flying back seat, and I had to have 12 hawks in the back seat to get familiar with radios and stuff. The guy in the front in our airplane, we've got three radios, a UHF, a Fox mic, and a VH, or a high freak. Well, high freak we don't use very often. UHF we usually use from tower to air or air to air, you know, to talk to the other planes. The Fox mic is the only thing you ever control, you know, talking to the ground pounders on. And so the guy in the back seat has got a Fox mic control box, and he keeps up with talking with the people on the ground. And a guy in the front seat talks to the people in the air. And you both listen to each other. You got receivers where you can hear what everybody says. So you could actually listen to four people. You could listen to a guy talking on UHF, a guy talking on Fox mic, and a guy talking on high freak, plus listening to the guy in the other seat through the intercom system. And so you can listen to all these things. And you listen on all of them, but you only talk on one at a time. Or, well, you can talk on a radio and then talk ICS. But that keeps you up to what everybody's doing. And so just talking in the back seat and talking with the ground controllers is enough to keep the back seat real busy. And the back seat does that and does all of the navigation, checking the navigation, determining exactly where you are, because everything's flat out here. The average height of the delta is probably 14 feet above sea level for a 150-mile area. And so you have no ground marks except the canals. A lot of canals don't change, but at night they're hard to find. So it's gotta be pretty busy there to keep up on navigation. Over here, where our usual patrol is a one day hop and three night hops. Yeah, three night patrols, and then a scramble. Okay, you have a day. The day pilots go down there at 11:45. They brief at 12 o'clock and launch at 1 until 3 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, another group of four pilots come in and stand by on scramble duty until 6:30, and then they brief and launch at 7:30. The afternoon group usually gets home about 3:30, and then they're finished. Well, the ones that launch at 7:30 in the evening fly for two and a half hours, get back about 9:30. There's another group that takes off at 9:30 and briefs an hour before that. So they leave at 9:30 and get back at 11:30. The third launch takes off at 11:30, gets back at 1:30. And this third group of four people, after they land, usually by the time they get landed and get their planes checked out and stuff, it's around 2:30 or 3 o'clock. And they stand by scramble until 11:45 in the morning. And that's what I was on last night. And in that time, I got scrambled twice, plus flew my two and a half hour flight. So I got a lot of flight time in last night. But tonight we're gonna have five night patrols. Well, we're gonna have five night patrols, and then have scramble birds, two sets of scramble birds for the daytime. Chuck doesn't like to go out in the daytime, so we're gonna keep birds in the air all night for next few nights. That's why I've got to fly here in about another couple hours. I wanted to get this tape done before I get some sleep. I'll get it off, get it in the mail tomorrow. But before I hit the rack here, I was going to finish this off. The people over here have been ending up with getting about average about 70 hours a month. Which, like Jerry, he got about 140. But we keep damn busy on it. We get 70 hours a month, and usually about 55 of that is nighttime flying, because all of our flying is at night. At night, without a moon, it's a damn hard to find your way around here. And there's no, in the whole Delta, there's one TACAN station. And as when you get down on the coast, 50 miles away, you don't have that. So you don't know where you are except by knowing where you are on the ground. And our squadron has got this policy. They have never shot in the wrong spot, and until they can get all four people in the two planes to agree that actually is a target area, they won't shoot. Like one of the first nights I was here, we got up in this area, and we're called in to shoot, and it was. We looked at the area, and it was really pinpointed by a canal going, or two canals that went perpendicular to each other. And the one long canal, everybody knew, but there was another canal that joined it. And our place to where we wanted to shoot was right out from this junction, about 200 meters. So it really seemed real simple to find. We looked at our map, we found it, and they says, everybody, this is where we want to shoot, right? I'm sitting there, and this is my second hop. And I came up, and I says, Commander, I says, no. Here I am, just coming from the States, and I thought, boy, they're really going to jump on me for being a dum-dum, but I couldn't see that was the right place. And so they says, what do you mean, no? And I says, it doesn't look right. And they said, okay, we won't shoot. And we circled around, and it turned out the canal that we'd come up on was about 300 meters from another canal. The canal that we were on was a brand new one, and the canal that we wanted to be on was about 300 meters away that had been growing over with weeds and stuff, and we had to go down fairly low to find it. And I guess it didn't make a hell of a lot of difference, but it's just that they listened to me, and they said, until four people agree, they just won't shoot, which is a damn good idea. Over here, we're working the birds a lot more than what we ever did in North Island. Every time we take off, it's at max takeoff weight plus a little bit more. Usually we're a little overgrossed for takeoff. We carry on an average run probably 12 5-inch Zunis. This is a 5-inch rocket that weighs around 120 pounds and has a 27-pound warhead. It's the biggest rocket a light support carries. It's a big damn rocket. It'll wipe out an area of 100 feet square, or 100 foot circle, 100 foot diameter circle, just flat obliterated. It's really a fierce mother. I dropped one in a hut the other day, as I said. And as I guess I was lucky as hell, because I know how to shoot, but I was lucky. I dropped one in a hut, and I dropped one about 4 feet from the hut, which still demolished it. The one that I put down the hut just kind of dissolved the hut, and a guy on the ground goes, damn, there was a hut there, and they were in bunkers, and they were shooting at me, and they're not anymore. And I go, oh, yeah, right. But this 5-inch rocket is really a good thing. So I carry about 12 of those, and then we carry one minigun. It's a SU-11. It shoots 6,000 rounds a minute, which is a whole pile of rockets. Every fifth round is a tracer, and when you press it at night, it looks like you've just got an extension, a big finger sticking out of your airplane that reaches the ground, and you can sit there and write your name on the ground with it. And so that's real nice. And then we usually carry about 2 2.5 or 2 3/4 inch rockets, which are real good for strafing and stuff. They'll go through trees and then blow up and kill it, and mess up things for about 20, 25 feet. So they work real good. And you can, these are all pretty accurate. But the way we're flying a plane, just really overloaded. It's interesting. You got to be right up with it. The skipper that we've got, the commanding officer over here, is spent two tours. One tour was a test pilot. He was in the American test pilot program for 2 years, and then he graduated with top grades, and so they sent him to the Empire Test Pilot School. And I guess he's flown every jet that the Navy has, and all the jets of Britain. And I guess I've never flown with him, but he is really a sharp son of a gun. Just a number one aviator, top notch, just really good. But, well, it looks like my tape is about run out. So I'll sign off for now. Sorry about talking all the time. How's everything at home? Funny, send that tape or something right away. And Jerry, hi, Pops, and thanks a lot for everything. You know, I'll get one off here next time I get some time. So, see you, bye.